Okay. So, last week we started talking about how, after the period of the Gemara of Chazal, how the Gaonim and the Rishonim, essentially the medievals, viewed Agadah. And a few general things we said, just to put it in context, is that you have this fundamental shift that Agadah is no longer a process or a subject of study, and neither is Halakha, but rather we're talking about texts, and first and foremost we're talking about the Bavli. The question is, we're talking about a particular text, is it Agadah, is it Halakha? If it is Agadah, what does that mean? What are the implications? How are we to understand it? So it becomes a different set of concerns, and those are the sets of concerns that are going to follow us straight through to our own concerns, because that's what we're going to have. We're going to have a text in front of us. We're going to have to be concerned with. The other thing we talked about was this sort of disconnect that happens sometime, it seems, in the period of the Gaonim or before the period of the Gaonim, where there's this lack of continuity, the cultural continuity, in terms of the study of Agadah. And whereas Halakha is always a discourse of insiders, that it just seems that there's just sort of a natural understanding. No one sort of questions, what's this halakha doing here? How do we understand it? People might disagree on how to understand it, but everyone takes it for granted that they understand what's going on. Whereas in Agadah, people, are, generally speaking, are writing as outsiders. They're like, what is this stuff? What's it doing here? What the heck, you know, how did this get into Judaism almost? So, and this break, as we said, happens very quickly after the end of the period of Chazal. Almost startlingly quickly does Agadah just start to look weird. And this leads to all sorts of different attempts to explain Agadah. What is it? How do we define it? What's it doing here? Etc. And the first major school that we talked about was the Gaonim. And what we said was basically the Gaonim it's vastly oversimplified. You read some, choice texts which make it seem very clear cut and simple. Obviously, there was a lot more going on, but the simple outline of what they thought is that everything is either halakha or agadah. You can clearly divide the two. If it's halakha, then it comes from Har Sinai, it is from God, you can't argue with it, you just got to do whatever it says, period, end of story. On the other hand, if it's Agadah, which basically means anything that's not Halakha, which is the negative definition of Agadah, which is going to be, you brought popcorn? You can't teach while eating popcorn. You can't teach while eating popcorn.
Sure.
So, Agadah says, in Agadah, basically, has almost no value, has no authority. Whatever they say, whatever it says, it's just an opinion. If you don't like it, no big deal. You want to, if you don't think it sounds reasonable, it's okay, have your own ideas. We said that on the one side, this sort of approach was sort of crucial to the development of Judaism, because otherwise, Judaism would sort of been held answerable to every line of the Gemara, which is just very long, and it would be very difficult to develop any sort of theology or virtually anything if you really had to reconcile yourself to every last word. On the other side, though, as we said, it seems a little hard to stomach, this notion that you open up a Gemara, you flip through, in Daf Yomi, and it all looks the same. It's all in the same print. It's all in the same Aramaic. It's hard to imagine that there's some imperceptible line where one line is Torah and it's from God and the other line is just some guy's opinion. And it's all wrapped up in one book and we're supposed to just pick it apart and ignore, it's very hard to say. But as we said, Moshe Feinstein, at least according to Rav Shurkin, seems to have believed this. Rav Shurkin said to me that... Rav Shurkin said that he asked Rav Moshe, can you say Birchot HaTorah on the medical passages of the Gemara? And he said no. It's just their opinions about medicine. It's not Torah. That's the whole point. He wasn't bound by it.
But that wasn't an opinion explicitly about Agada.
The implication
is that not everything in the Gemara is,
Rav Shurkin understood that in terms of Agada. That's what was so wild about it. While his boss, Rabbi Meiselman, is condemning as Epicurusim people who challenge the Gemara, he is saying, of course, all important rabbis throughout history all believe that you don't have to take any of this stuff seriously. And that's just the mainstream of Judaism. Of course, there's some other people who believe otherwise. I didn't have the chutzpah to ask him about what his boss had said, but it was rather striking. But the point is the position. I mean, like I said, assuming that he's a reliable source, which I think on this he should probably is. Rav Moshe, up to this day, that very mainstream positions seem to think yeah, but it's a very hard thing. As we said, what does that mean? You learn Daf Yomi. Get in the middle of Baba Basra, and all of a sudden it just goes on and on and on and on, all this Agada. So these people basically have just, someone who learns Daf Yomi every day isn't really learning Torah every day. It's hard to accept. But, so that was the going. Then we started talking about the Rashi and the Balei Tosfot. And, you said that that's the radical opposite, the other side. An official popcorn dish?
Official popcorn dish.
Okay.
The opposite of the Yonim?
The radical opposite, they don't really make a distinction. And this reflects when we say you open up a Gemara and you flip through, it all looks the same, more or less. It's true that a trained eye, as you mentioned, can guess whether or not there's halacha or agada on a page. But part of what makes the page of the Gemara, that we think of page of the Gemara, is, well, there's Rashi on one side, Tosfot on the other side. And the point is that, it's true that Tosfot becomes much more sparse in agadic discussions. Rashi and the Balei Tosfot just go through the entire Gemara. Just do page after page after page. And Rashi certainly doesn't have a radically different method. He's just explaining the text as he sees it. And even the Balei Tosfot, as we said also, it's the same sort of approach, the same sort of attempt to reconcile things. The line between halacha and agada is very unclear, and there are all these famous Tosfot, and we talked about this, Tosfot's question about Eliyahu HaNavi. If Eliyahu HaNavi was Pinchas, then he was a Kohen, so then how could he revive this kid, because the kid was dead, and so how could he touch the kid? So that happens to be a bad example, I realize afterwards, for technical reasons, but that sort of thing. And that, as we said, sort of represents a certain whole approach, a sort of holistic approach to the Gemara, and as opposed to, as we said, Chochmei Sfarad, the line of the Ramban, effectively, the Ramban, the Rashba, the Ritva, who only do what to this day are known as the Yeshivish Masechtas. They only write their Chidushim, Masechtot that are of real halachic significance, the core of Nezikin, the questions of monetary issues. They'll do Brachot, they'll do parts of Moed that are relevant to today. So Pesachim will get huge attention in terms of Hilchot Pesach, but then they just don't, kudge and forget about it. And so too, Agadah is bracketed. The Rashba writes a separate work, Chidushi Agadah. So these are two separate things, whereas the approach of Rashi in the Balei Tosfot is it's one whole block, Miksha Achai. However, this takes us to another problem, though. Because in doing that, they're also fundamentally taking the Agadah literally. In this sense, in a way, they're not much different from the Gaonim. They assume the Gemara says that's what it means. Now, in a lot of cases, okay, fine. But it raises issues which to this day most people don't really acknowledge, and it's really only recently been, I think, thoroughly shown. That what happens, you can get to all these Gemaras, and we will get to them, because a lot of them are in Brachot, in the beginning of Brachot. God does all sorts of funny things, and he seems to have a body, first and foremost, and he certainly seems to, And he does, you know, the Gemara at the beginning of Bracha, I'm a little ahead, but, you know, God cries, and he does all sorts of stuff, which, from what we've been taught about God, from saying, So, the question is what's going on here? For we all learn about God, you know, from Yigdal, basically, right? And it doesn't sound like God's supposed to be able to cry. He certainly doesn't seem to have feet, which he rubs in various points. He doesn't clap his hands, and he doesn't moan, and he doesn't have a body. You know, it says God puts on tefillin. Well, put on tefillin, l'chora, you either at least have an arm or a head, probably both, right? So, but it seems very clear that Balei Tosfot took this very seriously, and accepted this very literally, and therefore it seems that they believe. And what's it called? Our neighbor Marat Beit Shemesh, Nassim Slifkin, who came up before, also, sorry, not Tan Slifkin, Nassim was just a pen name, but he actually wrote a very nice article in Chakira on Rashi, showing that was Rashi a corporealist? Did Rashi believe that God has a body? And I think he did more than just review the sources. I think he made a really decisive argument in favor of Rashi believing that God has a body. And this is really the basic, and this is something that has been so pushed out of our heads, because the Rambam on this one point, even though his philosophy is almost irrelevant to the history of Judaism in a lot of ways, but on these particular points he really made it big. And you know, and the truth is, what does the word Tzelem Elokim mean? So we always have this assumption, and the Rambam is very clear, Tzelem Elokim refers to some inner spiritual, intellectual, cognitive, whatever similarity to God. But it seems a simple shot in the Pesukim. Tzelem Elokim means, this refers to the human body. That's how we have Tzelem Elokim, is through the body. And there are lots of midrashim which we see, which we actually, people cite all the time, but don't really think about, which seems to suggest this. So one of the most famous ones in Rashi, I think it's in Rashi, I didn't double check it, in Ki Teitse, right? Why can't you leave, what's the mashal about why you can't leave a body hanging. Out, hanging? Right, so what does that mean? So what does Rashi say? What's it like? He says it's like a king had a twin brother. And the king's the twin brother, so he tells him they hang the king's brother, you don't leave him hanging, right? Or just put on an iron mask, I guess. But so
that doesn't have to be taken literally, though.
It doesn't. The mashal doesn't.
Maybe they understood literally.
The mashal. Mashal's not literal.
No, the mashal isn't literal, but the implication is. What does it mean that we're concerned about Tzelem Elohim in a dead body if the Tzelem Elohim is talking about the soul?
Right. Okay.
I mean that's the bottom line. Famous also, you know, the thing from Hillel that he told his Talmidim that was a mitzvah in the bathhouse and he was doing a big mitzvah, and they said, "What's the mitzvah?" He says, "What do you mean? This is Tzelem Elohim. We got to take care of it." Right? Not just as we learn it that this is the kli in which God has put our soul and therefore we should take care of it. But no, the body itself has to be taken care of because the body itself somehow reflects God. This is something that now And it was precisely these issues which were at the core of the Maimonidean controversy. We'll get to the Rambam, but the Rambam obviously insisted that you couldn't read these Gemaras literally, and that was just absurd. And this was what was going back and forth, and they were accusing each other of believing in basically each side of Kfira. And you know they were burning Mar Nevuchim and burning Sefer Amada, I think the first part of the Mishnah Torah. And these are the central issues. So the question of the proper interpretation of Agadah became really one of the turning points of all of medieval Jewish philosophy. For instance, this guy I mentioned last time, Yaakov Elbaum from Hebrew U, published this survey of interpretation of Agadah from the Gaonim till, the early modern period. But you know he doesn't take he isn't willing to attribute all of this to the Balei Tosfot and to Rashi. we don't really see this formula. The problem is that Rashi and the Baalei Tosfot weren't philosophers. It wasn't like people like the Rambam who writes long essays about how to understand everything. They just do what they do. So it's hard to know exactly what they thought. And you could always argue with any of these things. Slifkin's argument on Rashi turns on one subtle reading of one Rashi, which happens not to have been printed in the regular Gemaras, so no one ever noticed it before. But who knows? But once you get a few centuries later, you get people like what was his name? Rav Moshe Taku, who always gets quoted, and also some of them Rav Yosef Ashkenazi in the 1500s. And this is the argument that he's making, which more and more it seems, from what I understand, people are saying is actually an accurate representation of what Rashi and Tosfot and the like said. Now I'll read. V'hine me'olam lo ra'inu gdolim kegon Rashi v'Tosfot sheyotziu davar mipshuto v'afilu ha'psukim shachamim mefarshim b'mashal lo matzinu she'amru shepshuto eino she'ena devarim kepshutam ach adirabba amrinan b'chol makom ein mikra yodei misei pshutam aval acher she'yishivim panim l'Torah Dorshimo told the Mashal Gamkein. Vimkein Kol Shekein Shdivrei HaTanaim En Yotzim Midei Pshutan. Kihem Tzrichim Lefaresh Divreihem Yoter Mehamikra. V'Kal V'Chomer B'no Shal Kal V'Chomer Amorash Shetzarich Lefaresh V'Chas L'Chachamim Lomar Dvarim She'inan She'inan V'Kol Shekein V'Davar Divrei Minut. And then he goes on. V'hinei b'emet kein hu, b'emet diber, ki Rashi v'Tosfot, v'kol chachbei Yisrael ha'amitiyim, we'll see who's not, according to him, kulam einam nevinim mufarshim otam ela kipshutam, ve'inu motzim shum davar me'advarim, chutz mipshutam, afilu v'ot echad. V'kol Rashi alfei Yisrael, asher lo ha'aminu b'aristo yimach shemo, kulam maminim b'tarat Moshe, u'v'divrei ha'chamim kipshutam. Umaminim afil bechol devarim shehem minanim ne'im etzla. As he puts in Eitzel HaRambam.
Yeah, Rambam.
So what he's saying basically, the interesting thing about the way he argues it, I think, which is counterintuitive to the way we're taught to think, is he's saying we're the rationalists. The Rambam's not a rationalist. These guys aren't rationalists. We're the rationalists. Why are we rationalists? Because we're saying pshat. We associate heavily pshat with a sort of rational approach. And they're saying, well, we're giving pshat in the psukh, in the Gemara. And they're just telling stories.
We being who?
We being Rashi, the Baalei Tosfot, and all true Jews who emerge from them. And that's, I think, sort of the crux in terms of the Baalei Tosfot and their value in terms of, or how we relate to them in terms of their interpretation of Agadah.
When he says pshat, he means a literal interpretation of all these
Pesach. Yeah.
That's what he means.
Right. So, on the one hand, you have the problem.
Because, I mean, you could argue that pshat is not always the literal interpretation.
Okay, this gets to the question of what's pshat and drash, but that's a separate class. Like I said, he's giving this simple meaning of the words, as opposed to saying it means something else. And we'll see the alternative in the Rambam. It's pretty clear what the alternative is once you hit the Rambam. It's just, you have to do them in an order, and I couldn't figure out which one should come first, so we did this first. If that's the case, on the one hand, there you have this real value that Rashi is usually much more valuable for understanding Agadot than the Rambam is. He actually explains what the text is saying. You read the Rambam, you get some whole theory, you know, and that's great. I mean, a classic example where basically the Svardi Rishonim are almost invariably wrong historically, and the Rashi and Baalei Tosfot are almost invariably right, is anything having to do with science. Because Rashi and the Baalei Tosfot were living in medieval Christian Europe. They didn't know any science. They just read the Gemara and said it told you what they thought it meant. The Rambam and all those people in the Islamic world, they knew science. They knew that the earth is round and that the sun goes around the earth, like every educated person knows. Right? and that the planets all go around the earth and that they're spheres. And they have to interpret the Gemara in terms of that. Just as, you know, these modern guys think that you have to read what's it called? Think that Bereshit is talking about quantum theory, right? Or relativity. It's the same thing, especially whether or not, you know, who's doing it. But so in that sense, there is a certain fundamental concreteness to their approach, just reading the text and seeing what the heck it says, which is very powerful. On the other hand, they sort of get stuck into this, but it's all authoritative. Why are they reading it the way it is? They're reading it the way it is because that's what it is, that's what it's supposed to be. And therefore, to deny any of it is also a problem. And then you find yourself in a very problematic world if you're trying to develop some sort of sophisticated, systematic, theological approach to the world, or scientific approach to the world, because you're just not going to be able to reconcile all these things, and that's the problem that you're going to have. So that's the Balei HaTosfot. As we said, ultimately though, the Balei HaTosfot, Rashi, the Ashkenazim, and the Gaonim all agree on one crucial point. It doesn't occur to them that there's any meaning to the Agadah other than what seems to be the simple meaning. One of them says, therefore, since the simple meaning is sometimes ridiculous, we should just ignore it. And the other side says, since the simple meaning is God's truth, therefore we must accept it no matter what, and reject the evil Greek philosophers and scientists. Now finally we get to the Rambam. Now what we have here, under source 8, our printer's down so I couldn't print you more sources, but, under source 8, is this passage, very famous passage from the Rambam. This is from the Rambam's intro to Perek Chelek. So Rambam wrote an introduction, wrote a perush to all of Mishnah. The first person, by the way, ever to write a perush on all of Mishnah, which has to do with the Rambam's all-inclusive vision of Torah. And he, the same thing that he writes Mishnah Torah, so the only person to cover all of Torah, all of Halacha. And the first thing he needs, therefore, to do is go through the entire Mishnah. And that's sort of his first step of his grand project. And what language does he write it in?
Arabic.
In Arabic. Which is why I didn't see any reason to give it to you in Hebrew. Though, to be honest, I don't know where Professor Twersky got this translation from in his textbook. So it's possible this is a translation from the Hebrew, in which case, we're going to assume that it's from the Arabic. And this is a very famous passage, which, as we'll see, has a parallel in the Mor Nebuchim later. At the beginning of Chelek, right, the last parak in Sanhedrin, this deals with who has a share in the world to come and who doesn't have a share in the world to come. Kol Yisrael Yeshem Chelek Olam Haba, except for my neighbor and that guy and that guy and all those guys. But, I mean, it's a very long list after everyone has, and then the list goes for a whole parak of who doesn't. And the Rambam takes this as an opportunity in his introduction to lay out sort of a lot of his fundamental theological positions. How to understand Agadah is also crucial to this, particularly because the Gemara Sanhedrin of Perek Chelek is one of the largest blocks of Agadah and is chock full of theologically important Agadot. Most importantly, a lot of discussion of Mashiach. And the source of the possibility that you don't have to believe in Mashiach is also there. So you really have to. So the Rambam is going to insist that you have to believe in it. He's going to need tools to deal with that. But so here, at one point, he announces as follows: "You must know that the world of the sages are differently the words of the sages are differently interpreted by three groups of people." Rambam likes to things get divided up into groups. The first group is the largest one. "I have observed them, read their books, and heard about them. They accept the teaching of the sages in their simple literal sense and do not think that these teachings contain any hidden meanings at all. They hold such opinions because they have not understood science and are far from having acquired knowledge. They possess no perfection and which would rouse them to insight from within, nor have they found anyone else who could rouse them to a similar understanding. They therefore believe that the sages intended no more in their carefully emphatic and straightforward utterances than they themselves understand with inadequate knowledge. They understood their teaching of the sages only in the literal sense. In spite of the fact that some of their teachings, when taken literally, even to the uneducated, let alone to the sophisticated scholars, their amazement would prompt them to ask how anyone in the world could believe such things are true, much less edifying. Who is the Rambam attacking here?
Rashi.
Rashi. I can say we wouldn't have identified it as Rashi, but it seems it's the school that we've identified with Balei HaTosfot. Now the question here is, and you have to really ask, I'd be interested in what Meir Lichtenstein thinks about this, just in terms of the rhetoric of the Mor Nevuchim, where he just is off it from what I've seen, very easily dismissive of anyone who disagrees with him and of virtually anyone but him. Is this really what he thinks? Is this a straw man that he's constructed based on the Balei HaTosfot? Is he complaining about masses of people who believe in a sort of bastardized position of the Balei HaTosfot? Or is he really saying, yeah, Rabbeinu Tam just doesn't know how to read a Gemara? I don't know. I don't know enough to to really put together. But the Rambam the reason why I put it all down is just to see the way in which he writes and just the authority.
This is part of more of Miranda.
No. This is the introduction to this. This is from his Perush HaMishnah. He wrote a long introduction to the 10th parak of Sanhedrin.
But it is the same thing, Miranda Vuchim.
Well, we'll see. Mor Nevuchim is a little different. We'll see. It's not, actually not quite as funny, so I that's why I give you this one. But there's other stuff in there. I'll read it to you. The members of this group are poor in knowledge. One can only regret their folly. Their very effort to honor and exalt the sages in accordance with their own meager understandings actually humiliates them. Now, I think through all this rhetoric, I think there's one extremely important... extremely important critique here, which is that who says there's part of the problem with Pshat. There's Pshat sort of elevates in a weird way human understanding. Right? That's a lot of the issue in terms of general Pshat and Drash and the whole in terms of just reading Pesukim.
Because it limits God.
It limits God by saying that the text is only going to mean what it can reasonably mean using natural human language. Divrei Torah v'Lashon Adam, exactly. So, but then what you're saying is that the text can't mean anything more than I'm capable of understanding. And wouldn't we expect of these holy texts to have things that are so sublime that even the greatest person isn't getting the whole thing? And they seem to say, no, it's very simple. This is what it is. You take out your grammar book, concordance, and you're in business.
Right, so the question is whether Balei HaTosfot, interpreted it this way to give a certain level of interpretation for the masses or for...
No, clearly Balei HaTosfot believe what they were saying. Balei HaTosfot don't seem to have any notion of that. This is the Rambam's way of thinking, that we gotta, send your message to different people in different forms. They clearly believe it. The question is, like I said, it's so harsh, without having someone else saying it, I would rather suggest that he's not directly attacked, he doesn't directly talk about people like Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam that way.
He wasn't burning their sword, they were burning his.
I don't know but this is long, long before then. This is why they're. But this is how he got. This is how he got himself to be burnt. supposedly he wrote the Perush Mishnayos. I think it was 18. That's the story. It's one of his earliest works. So it's not. As you'll see, he didn't change much in terms of that.
But what he's also saying is that it doesn't stand on its own. That you need all these outside influences and sources to understand. And I can understand why that would be controversial, because the other way of looking is that it stands on its own.
Right. On the other hand, is it saying the stands on its own means that, it's sort of ironic this is the way it comes down, but whatever happened to Misora? What do you mean anyone could understand the Gemara? You can just walk in and understand it. In fact, Rashi's it's true that Balei HaTosfot are fundamentally sort of coming at things fresh and saying, we can generate this whole new way of learning Gemara. But Rashi's fundamentally rooted in a very old, long tradition. And a lot of the stuff Rashi knows, he only knows because he heard it from his teachers. He knows what all these words mean. He doesn't know Greek. How does he know what all these words mean? He knows because there's a long tradition going back to the most ancient German scholars and the Gaonim also have their traditions. So I think you're 100% right. You got to one of the key questions, which is, in other words, is this autonomously understandable? But I don't think it's such a. I think both sides are. I don't think any one of them is necessarily problematic in that sense. Now, let's move on to the second group. The second group is also a numerous one. It too consists of persons who, having read, I guess that's or heard, the words of the sages, understand them according to their simple literal sense, and believe that the sages intended nothing else than what may be learned from their literal interpretation. Notice that could have been cut and pasted from the previous paragraph.
Yeah.
Rambam really shows how these two radically different approaches are, in a certain sense, are very parallel, in a certain sense, rooted in the similar assumptions. Inevitably, they ultimately declare the sages to be fools, hold them up to contempt, and slander what does not deserve to be slandered. They imagine their own intelligence of a higher order than that of the sages, and that the sages were simpletons who suffered from inferior intelligence. Members of this group are so pretentiously stupid that they can never attain genuine wisdom. Most of those who have stumbled into this error are involved with medicine or astrology. however remote they are from true philosophy compared to true philosophers. They are more stupid than the first group. Many of them are simply fools. If you hear the radio today, there's a whole back and forth because Moshe Aaron said that not every tembel can be sar bitachon. And what's it called? Immediately, what's his name? Peretz immediately got up and started giving press conferences about how this is racism against Spartan, and how can you say this about me? And Aaron was just like, I was just talking in general. I said that I thought it should be a civilian, but not any civilian. I just meant, so you got to be careful. I heard them right on the radio together. It's unbelievable, but anyway. Now here it's even funnier because I just don't know enough about reading these sorts of texts. But here it's even weirder because here he's really saying this about the Gaonim. The Gaonim really disparage Chazal. They're really so.
I don't think they did though.
Who Chazal?
I don't think he's talking about the Gaonim.
That's what I'm saying. The question is, who's he talking about? I don't know enough about.
How about
it just gets into these. What?
How about the Apikorsim? Who yank things out?
Right, they're people. Well, who are the Apikorsim? That's the question. Certainly, they're Karaites were talking like this. Mm-hmm. But
I mean, it's the conclusion that they draw. They look at these texts and they say, "This is ridiculous."
On the other hand, precisely in this caricaturization, this is a very powerful critique of the Gaonim. Because the Gaonim say, you look at the Gemara, similar to this question of Pshat with Bali Tosfot, you look at the Gemara, and you decide if it makes sense. And if the Agadah doesn't make sense, so you go on with your life. You are the ultimate arbiter. It doesn't even say that only the greatest of rabbis can decide if this is... It just says if it's not rational, that's it. You just move on. Don't worry about it. If you think you understand the Pasuk better, great. Don't worry about it. So, and he's saying, basically, these guys are getting up and saying we're smarter than Chazal, that we can understand things better. What can that possibly, how can you possibly say that? Like I said, would we actually define the Gaonim this way? I don't think so, but is the Rambam being fair if he's in fact attacking the Gaonim? Perhaps not. But does he have a very strong point, and does he make it very well by using this sort of rhetoric? I think so. It's a question of...
I don't think he's referring to the Gaonim.
Like I said, you have to see. I have no... It's too... okay. Now, this basic setup of these two groups appears much less, more concisely and with... Like I said, is this self-conscious humor or unself-conscious? It's hard to tell. In the Mora Nevuchim, towards the end... And then he gives a different. Then he talks about the third group. I'd like to actually read the Mora Nevuchim's version first, because it's actually the more straightforward one, or the more
of the third group.
Of the third group, his description of the third group. Okay. It says, but neither of the two groups understands that the Midrashim have the character of poetical conceits, whose meaning is not obscure for someone endowed with understanding. At that time, this method was generally known and used by everybody, just as the poets use poetical expressions. Thus, the sages, may their memory be blessed, say, Bar Kapara teaches, in the verse, and thou shalt have a paddle, yated, upon azenecha, thy weapon, do not read Azanecha Ela Aznecha, thy ear. This teaches us that whenever a man hears or represents a reprehensible thing, he should put his finger into his ear. Would that I knew whether, in the opinion of these ignoramuses, this Tanait, this Tana, believed this to be the interpretation of this text, such that such was the purpose of this commandment, that Yated, paddle, means finger, and that Azencha, thy weapon, refers to the two ears. I do not think that anyone of sound intellect will be of this opinion. But this is the most witty poetical conceit by means of which he instills a noble moral quality, which is in accordance with the fact that just as it is forbidden to tell them, so is it forbidden to listen to obscene things. And he props it up through a reference to a biblical text, as is done in poetical compositions. Similarly, all the passages in Midrashim enjoin, do not read this, but thus, have this meaning. And he goes on for a little while. What's the Rambam saying? What's the nature of Midrash? How do we have to read it?
Break the code,
and particularly what does it compare it to? What sort of text?
Poetry.
Saying these are literary texts. Mm-hmm. These are poetic texts. And like all poetic texts, they require confidence in order to read. Now, we generally take for granted the competence that we have in reading literary texts that we're familiar with, of the texts either from our tradition or from our modern culture. But there are all these sorts of conventions all over the place that we don't even pay attention to. Just little things in movies, the way movies cut back and forth between scenes. This had to be carefully figured out and developed how to do this. The first person, when the great train robbery, they figured out how to do a chase by showing scenes first of the bad guys and then of the posse coming after them, having them pass the same landmarks. You could see where they're going. This is a great breakthrough. We take all this for granted, and we follow these movies without any problem. But if you're coming to a text which is foreign, then these things have to be learned. And as I said, the point is that Agadah is foreign. And therefore, the methods of Agadah, the literary tools of it, the literary forms of it, have to be learned. And he's arguing that if you don't understand this, you won't be able to understand the text. And this happens all the time when people are reading ancient texts. They don't understand because they don't get what's going on. They don't understand the genre. They don't the conventions. They understand the genre. They don't understand what's going on. There's a famous text, I forget what it's called. It's now referred to the author as Pseudo-Boethius, and it was believed to be by the great philosopher Boethius until the 20th century, until someone figured out that this, in fact, was a medieval spoof on Boethius, written probably by a 15-year-old. But the guys who read these sorts of texts generally had no sense of humor, and it was totally missed, and people took this very seriously. And he's saying is, if you don't have that sort of sensitivity, you're not going to understand. And particularly when it comes to these sorts of comparisons, poetry is often a lot about drawing images from one place to another. So to take talking about a sar bitachon, so to update the classic example of a metaphor from Aristotle, if we were to say Arik Sharon, there's no politics here, I don't think. Arik Sharon was a lion. What do we mean?
He was like a lion.
He was strong.
He was like a lion.
Brave.
He was brave, strong, ruthless, brutal, whatever it is. Like I said, you can take your pick on it. But how do you know that I don't mean that Ariel Sharon was, you know, like you see in the zoo? He was a Leonis, whatever the Latin name for it is, right? How do we know that? We know that because we have an understanding of the way these conceits work, both in poetry and just in this case in our regular talk. Now, and if you lack a certain knowledge of Hebrew, you don't understand that when you call Ariel Sharon a lion, you're doing a play on his name. So that will also be completely missed. If you don't have these pieces, it takes a whole set of competences to understand that it doesn't mean that he had a tail, it doesn't mean that he had a big mane, which you could refer to someone as a lion-like person because he's sort of this big sort of teddy bear but lion-like person with a big beard and a sort of big thing of hair, and that could also be he's a lion, but in a totally different sort of way. So the Rambam is saying you need to learn to understand these things, and then you will. And once you understand these are not simple texts, which have a simple pshat, transparent texts, like a newspaper text, which is supposed to simply convey information directly, but in fact poetic texts, and you learn the tools, and then you'll understand what's going on. That's the Rambam in the Mor Nevuchim. Interestingly, in the more popular book, in the Perush LeMishnayot, he has a sort of more esoteric or mysterious interpretation. What does he say? He says, there's a third group. Its members are so few in number, that's hardly appropriate to call them a group. Except in the sense someone speaks of the sun as a group, or species, of which is the only member. And then he says, this group consists of men to whom the greatness of the sages is clear. Does this group exist? He's talking about himself, it seems. Right? But he doesn't want to say it exactly. And then he continues to use the plural.
The royal we.
It's the royal we. He does use the plural, but he basically compares himself to the sun. And he says, well, in philosophical terms, it's a group because there's nothing else that fits into that categorization. And therefore, we can call it a group. But really, it's not a group.
I've only met one person like that so far.
So it's sort of weird, but that's what he seems. It seems that that's what he's saying. They recognize the superiority of their intelligence from their words, which point to exceedingly profound truths. Even though this,
what? He's talking about the sages here.
The sages, right? Even though this third group is few and scattered. Their books teach the perfection. Once again, is this all a fake? I can't figure this out.
Why would you say it's a fake? He's probably talking about not only himself, Aristotle.
But Aristotle didn't read Agadah.
Well,
I'm not sure who he's. That's the question. I don't know. And it might be if you really know your history of Jewish philosophy. And say, no. He's talking about.
Is he limiting this to Torah and Jews? And
it sounds like he says there's only one member of this group.
The Nevi'im, the philosophers, and himself.
It could be, but it sounds like he says that there's only one member of the group. When he says that, just like the sun is a group, right? If there are two people, you don't have a problem calling it a group. The problem is that how is it a group if there's only one person? Well, it's a group of one because it's the only category. So I'm not sure. I just don't know what he's referring to, what he's actually referring to. But in terms of the abstract ideas, members of this group understand the sages knew as clearly as we do the differences between the impossible of the impossible and the existence of that which must exist. They know that the sages did not speak nonsense. And it's clear to them the words of the sages contain both an obvious and hidden meaning. Thus, whenever the sages spoke of things that seem impossible, they're employing the style of riddle and parable, which is the method of the truly great thinkers. For example, the greatest of our wise men, Solomon, began his book by saying, to understand an analogy and a metaphor, the words of the wise and their riddles. All students of rhetoric know the real concern of the riddle is with its hidden meaning and not with its obvious meaning. As, let me now put forth a riddle to you. Since the words of the sages I transcribe this to supernatural matters, which are ultimate, they must be expressed in riddles and analogies. What's the difference in this version of the third group?
The difference between what and what?
Between the Mor Nevuchim, which we saw before, and this new iteration of it.
One thing that he says is that when it seems impossible, that's when it's a riddle or a parable. In other words, some of it might be taken literally and some of it may not be.
So first of all, right, there seems to be different levels of Agadah, and this is important because the Rambam fundamentally bought into the Gaonim's worldview, as he basically did not feel that Agadah was binding in the same way that Halakha was. And therefore, the fact that he's sort of separating them out, he's now separating out categories. So he's only talking about one category. And what's the nature of this category, though?
Riddle and parable.
What?
Riddle and parable.
Yeah, but what is that? Why is, how is that?
Meaning
what's the nuance? What's the difference
between this one is a riddle?
Well, a riddle can be a type of literature. I mean, we don't think of it as such, but in certain cultures,
but
riddles
he
are.
He certainly seems to have elevated it.
Yeah.
In its value or its meaning, it's only the wise men, the greatest of the... First of all, by virtue of the fact that he says the greatest of our wise men, Solomon, began his book by saying, to understand an analogy and a metaphor, so he seems to be equating the metaphor, the riddles, the parables, which translate into
you know, the only time we use it is for the impossible thing. So he seems to be equating it with it, something that Shlomo HaMelech did, which means that it has to be... important.
It's definitely important. Yeah. But more than important, what does he say at the end?
Only the wisest.
Supernatural.
Right, but then he says, all students of rhetoric, so on the one hand he's giving you the same sort of literary interpretation, mm-hmm. No, the real concern of a riddle is with its hidden meaning. We're talking about, there's two meanings, right.
And he's saying they're missing the boat again. And
they're
some
missing,
people aren't going to get it.
And some people aren't going to get it. And what are these hidden meanings?
The supernatural.
Yeah, what are they in the Rambam's terms? What does he call this stuff?
Mista.
No, the Rambam definitely didn't call it Mista. What does he call it? No, but what in general does the Rambam call this? Philosophy. Right? Which for the Rambam, you've got these sort of, you know, there's the exoteric, that which the masses all understand and all learn, which includes all of halacha, and all these various agadot, which might have some surface meanings that might entertain the masses. But ultimately, the real meaning, the ultimate truth, is these philosophical truths, which aren't just difficult to apprehend, that you need to train your mind and your whole spirit in order to be able to understand these deep philosophical truths about God and the nature of the universe, but they're supposed to be kept secret. We don't want them getting out. It's not necessarily explicit here. I'll see if it's...
It's a very small group.
And the other things, I don't think he deals really here with whether they're binding or not.
No, he doesn't.
He just says there's hidden meaning and there's obvious meaning, and some things can be taken literally and some not. But he doesn't say whether they're,
well, because,
you know, as binding as
halakha. Well, the Rambam is less, in this case, right. The case in the Mohra is an interpretive section. He's actually talking about interpreting the psukim about lulav. There. About lulav, he's interpreting psukim, and he says, "Look, this is the way Chazal interpret psukim." Mm-hmm. Here it sounds like he's talking about philosophy. He's talking about theology. He's saying that it's not a question of right. It's not a question of binding or not binding. It's a question of truth. This is the truth. This is the true philosophical truth. The true nature of God, the true nature of the universe, is somehow contained within this text. And if you know how to get it, you're going to get it.
He's referring to Agadah.
Yeah, that's what he's talking. Exactly what he's talking about.
The words of the sages.
Okay, I didn't. Right, I cut it off. You must know
because
it's right. Yeah. Okay. No. That's true. You can check me up on that. So therefore, Agadah is fundamentally something that, or at least a certain subset of Agadah, has to do with philosophical truths. The question of binding or not binding is no longer relevant. It's a question of...
Clearly it is, actually. He's saying the words of the sages are, you know, he says they're important, they're true, they're real.
They're true. They're really true and binding.
It's the way he interprets it that's different from Rashi and Bali Tosfot. It's not, you know...
No, but there's a difference between binding and true. In other words, the Rambam's just saying that this is the absolute truth. And he knows it's the absolute truth without having ever opened up a Gemara. He knows these are first principles which true philosophers of all faiths have known. And we can derive it from first principles and through all sorts of intellectual speculation. He's saying Chazal also knew all this stuff and believed in this stuff. And it's all there. And this is the truth. As opposed to saying, whereas from what I understand, what Tosfot's saying is, well, if the Gemara says that God has a foot, then God must have a foot. The Rambam doesn't work that way. The Rambam has a preconception of God, and then he says, and Gemara obviously shares my conception of it. So, it's not a question of binding. It's just the way things are. He's a much more. So the Rambam here has this. So the Rambam, on the one hand, these are things which are absolute realities. These are things which can't be understood by everyone. But these are also things which are dangerous to let out to too many people, which is the reason why it's necessary to formulate them in these sorts of ways. And therefore, he attaches this whole notion, he therefore feels that we have to read Agadah allegorically. Now...
But maybe not all of it.
Not all of it, clearly not all of it. You pointed that out, or someone pointed that out. That's clearly not all of it. It's basically the ones that are talking about God. And the ones that are talking about, basically, they're ones that are talking about things that the Rambam has already prejudged through his philosophical system as being impossible. And therefore, we have to go back and read them. Now, this is a very old tradition. Arguably, it's a fundamentally non-Jewish tradition of allegory. Allegory is what you do with a text when you can't get rid of it because you've accepted it as holy or whatever it is, but it doesn't make any sense to you anymore. So you say, well, it's talking about allegory. Allegory is of the Greek allos, other. It's talking about something else. And once we say it's talking, and therefore it's pointing to some other event, to some other discussion, and that's what it's really talking about. And this goes back to the Greeks had this problem with Homer, because everyone thought Homer was the basis of all culture, but it really is not very interesting if you're a philosopher to read about these guys killing each other. So therefore, it really has to be talking about other things.
And Plato used a lot of allegory.
Plato certainly used allegory also, though he was against allegorizing Homer because he just wanted to get rid of it and kill all the poets. But... this tradition comes through is entirely central to all Christian interpretation of anything they interpret just about. But is based the reason why it's problematic is that it's rooted fundamentally, certainly in the interpretation of Tanakh, it's rooted fundamentally in a fundamental division of body and soul. Because what you're saying is that there's, and this is, I mean, these are just the Christian terms, but the Rambam, one way or another, is using a similar set of tools. What you're saying is that a text has a body, there's a letter of the law, and there's a spirit of the law, a spirit of the text. And that there's, that they're connected, eichshehu, but the body is really just as we were saying. In this older vision, you have the body is the Tzelem Elohim. Now the body is just the kli. And what the real interest is to get whatever's in the kli, not the kankan, but mashayishva. And therefore, therefore, once you have that notion of this radical split in existence, texts start reading this way also. If you believe that there's really ultimately, you know, olam hazeh is basically what there is, for whatever reason, and that you don't have the same radical split of body and soul, even if you have different realms of existence, so then it's going to become more complicated. But the Rambam is very much bought into this sort of Greek way of thinking. As I said previously, Chazal, it's a great misdescription to say that Chazal made an allegory out of Shir HaShirim. By the Middle Ages, people certainly are making allegories out of Shir HaShirim for the same reason. You have a text that is part of Tanakh but doesn't make sense. So what do you do with it? Well, you say, well, it's obviously talking about something else. There's some deeper secret. So that's the Rambam. Very quickly, and what the Rambam does for us most importantly is he breaks the dichotomy between Balei Tosfot and the Gaonim. He creates this middle ground. He says, well, there's more to it. It's not so complicated. It's not all or nothing. There might be parts of which we reject, the allegory, the peel, but there's something deeper in there. So he creates this. He creates a much more supple approach. I just want to quickly throw out the approach of Kabbalah, which might ultimately be the most influential approach. Usually we think of Kabbalah versus, you know, rational philosophy, the Rambam, as being two opposites. But in the big picture, they're actually pretty similar. If you consider that most of Judaism, most historically, wasn't interested in the sorts of questions that either of them are interested in. They're both attempting to create systematic explanations of how God works and how the universe works. They might have radically different starting points and conclusions, but fundamentally they're both talking about Nistar. They're both saying that there's some hidden teaching beyond the halacha, right? A litvak doesn't need any of this stuff, right? at least the modern litvak, the Gra obviously was the mekubal, but you just have halacha. What's the big deal? You just read the psukim. What's the big deal? But this notion that there's this deeper meaning which has to do with the inner life and the eternal soul and its relationship to God, in that sense they're really akin, and in terms of Agadah, these sorts of Kabbalistically influenced approaches to Agadah in some ways are very similar in the sense that they too are arguing for a symbolic meaning of the Midrash, an allegorical meaning. And they'll say, well, this refers to this sphere, and that refers to that sphere, or what have you. But basically, they're still saying that there's a deeper meaning to this text. And the simple meaning, you're right, does sound silly, but there's a deeper meaning. On the other hand, they're infinitely more comfortable with all these descriptions of God. They're much more comfortable talking about God. The Rambam's problem is that he's put himself in a box where he can't talk about God, and then has all of these sources which talk about God. I mean, so he's like, God does this, God does that. You have to understand what it really means, but talking about God this way is a much more natural sort of thing. And in that sense, they're more tuned into the sort of mystical end of Agadic thinking. There certainly is a mystical aspect to it. And particularly to the extent that they actually are the legitimate inheritors of the mystical traditions that are floating around the Gemara. And they change, they develop, and all of that. But fundamentally, they're in tune with it. Even if you'll say, well, yeah, but really this is an anachronistic reading.
That word?
Anachronistic. Out of time.
Out of time.
Okay.
Right. So
ahistorical.
Yeah,
okay. So that's the Rambam. This takes us to the Ramban. Sorry, the Ramban is probably where you're going to see this sort of stuff, where the common person is most likely to see this stuff in the Ramban's Kabbalistic interpretations on the Chumash. And I don't know that much about it, but Elliot Wolfson, who is probably one of the leading scholars of Kabbalah today, wrote an article on the Ramban's use of Kabbalah in his Perush on the Torah. And he argues, he has a nice image, he says that in the Ramban, what you have is Midrash transposed into a Kabbalistic key. That these Midrashim are reworked in such a way with slight touches and slight changes in perspective and emphasis in such a way that they gain this Kabbalistic tinge. And he's sort of able to absorb the Midrashim into a Kabbalistic worldview. That's like I say, I'm not qualified to go into any great depth on these things, but this is certainly a major field out there, and I think we might hit here and there, particularly because it influences one of the most influential, among the most influential in the long-term interpreters of Agadah are the Maharsha, who once again also wrote on all of Shas, and he was a very basic interpreter, and he wrote on Agadah. The Maharal, all these people are people who are drawing, who have Kabbalistic influences, even if, you know, whether or not they're actual Kabbalists might not be. So these things have, this sort of approach runs through. Now, just to wrap up this whole introduction, next week we'll start with the actual Ein Yaakov. So what do we get from all of this, all these pieces, all these different approaches, all of which seem to have upsides and downsides? And I think that what you really need to do is you need an eclectic approach. You have to recognize that part of the point is that Agadah is just a category of exclusions, this big catch-all phrase, and there's all sorts of different stuff there, and it's going to take different tools in different places. And on the one hand, you're going to need a sort of interesting combination. You're going to need the flexibility of the Gaonim to say, I'm not bound by everything that's stated there, certainly in terms of science. The question whether that applies to history or not is, I tend to say it doesn't, but whether or not the Gaonim thought that is not clear to me at all. But on the other hand, an acceptance of what the text says, as the Balei Tosfot do, and as Rashi does. And the key turn is, and this is a very dangerous thing, but I don't think we really have any choice, is to separate out what we think and what Chazal think. In other words, you have to be able to say, this is what the text says. I know this is what the text says. This is what the words mean. Oh, this contradicts everything I understand about God. Okay. But a willingness to create that gap is the only way that you're going to get that. Now, you might argue that by doing that, you might destroy the entire religious nature of the undertaking, but it's the only way, it seems to me, to get at what's going on. On the other hand, there's the Rambam throws in this extremely important notion of these texts as literary texts, which have to be understood using certain types of tools, and which have to be understood from within, what are the conventions of this genre of Midrash, of Agadah, and what have you, and not just to presuppose. And the notion of both the Kabbalists and of the Rambam, that there's something deeper here, that something's going on. And you don't want to use that to impose meaning which isn't there. On the other hand, the notion that there's something transcendent, that there's something reaching, that you're not that it's okay not to get everything, and not to dismiss meaning that you haven't figured out yet, which is what the Rambam is arguing against, I think is really crucial. So next week, I guess I'd like to start. We'll start with the Mishnah, which the Ainyaku starts with the Mishnah. We'll talk about why. From now on, the idea is basically any text of is okay. Either if you have an Ainyaku, that's fine. If you have, or just any text of Masechet Brachot, a regular Gemara, Steinsaltz. I'm probably going to have to bring all three, just so I can keep. Just so people know where they are. That's the only thing. Because
we have Gemara.
What?
We have more.
Okay, people don't have. I'm saying people want to bring their own Gemara, whatever it is.
We have enough.
I assume that you have because they've been, everyone has, what's it called?
Okay. Had bar mitzvah.
Everyone had a, yeah. Okay. It's a question of size. People
have big, we have all the
big
sizes.
Okay. Little,
the very
means,
beer, halacha, everything.
Oh, okay.
You're talking about
very
the Gemara,
good.
Right?
What?
Yeah.
The Talmud, yeah, the Babylonian Talmud.
Right. Yeah. Right?
Okay. Okay, very good.
All right.
Thank you.
Every size.
All right. I'll bring
every
size.
If you want to write anything. Thank you. Right. Anyone who wants to make a donation for coming.
Let's stop.
Good night.
Good night.